Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karina Moreno, assistant professor with Long Island University's School of Business, who discusses President Trump's reversal of his own policy, separating immigrant families, and the conditions inside private for-profit immigrant detention centers. Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program with the Center for International Policy, who assesses progressive Mexican presidential candidate López Obrador's platform and what changes his predicted victory will likely bring to Mexico in relations with the U.S., and Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, who in addressing a June 23rd rally in Washington, D.C., asserted this is the beginning, not the end, of a new movement calling for a national moral revival. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Teachers and parents in Puerto Rico won a brief reprieve as a judge blocked the government's move to close 9 public schools in the island's northeast and rural districts. The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, ravaged by Hurricane Maria and a decade-long debt crisis, has ordered the closure of 25% of all public schools on the island due to falling enrollment. It's estimated that the planned closures will displace 60,000 students. Puerto Rico's Department of Education said it would appeal the judge's decision. Department spokeswoman Yolanda Rosali told the Associated Press that the government expects an enrollment drop of some 70,000 students by this August. The island currently has more than 1,100 public schools that serve 319,000 students, but that number keeps declining as families continue to move to the U.S. mainland due to an 11-year recession and the devastation caused by Hurricane Maria last year. If all planned closures go forward, 835 schools will remain operational. In March, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, signed a law that for the first time will allow for the establishment of charter schools and vouchers. Charter schools are publicly funded, but independently run. Vouchers, which allow public money to be spent on private schools, are praised by some for giving more choice to parents. Opponents contend that they drain money from the public school system. In response to Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian influence in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, congressional Republicans have turned their attention to environmental groups, like the Natural Resources Defense Council, alleging that they may be advancing the interests of Russia and China. Utah Congressman Rob Bishop, chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, alleges NRDC has become an agent of the Chinese Communist Party because of the group's opposition to fracking and energy exploration in the United States and criticism of the Trump administration's weakening of U.S. environmental regulations. Now, a broad spectrum of U.S. civil society groups with extensive international programs fear they will be labeled as foreign agents by Republicans who are attempting to weaponize the 80-year-old federal law requiring the registration of foreign agents. The Los Angeles Times reports that advocates for U.S.-based nonprofit groups worry that a legal tool, the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act, meant to protect American institutions, could be used to attack those out of favor in today's Republican Party-dominated Washington. Canada will become the second nation in the world after Uruguay to legalize marijuana this October. The move is a major victory for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who says that undercutting the black market for the drug through taxation and limiting sales to government stores are among his goals. 9 U.S. states have legalized the recreational use of marijuana. However, the American federal government still classifies marijuana as a Schedule I illegal drug, subject to harsh penalties. In Canada, the federal government will place strict limits on the marketing and promotion of legal pot. The Canadian Parliament's legislation legalizes marijuana possession, home growing, and sales for adults. Ottawa will oversee remaining criminal sanctions, including penalties for sales to minors and the licensing of producers. Provincial governments will manage sales and distribution and be permitted to impose stricter regulations, such as raising the minimum age for purchase. The law will go into effect on October 17th this year. Canada's new marijuana law conflicts with a series of international drug control treaties adopted in the 1970s and 80s. But according to Vox, Canadian legislation comes as drug reformers from around the world are putting pressure on the United Nations to overhaul global drug policy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After weeks of growing outrage, protests, and government agency confusion, President Trump issued an executive order on June 20th, reversing the policy he initiated to separate children from their immigrant parents seeking asylum or refuge in the U.S. However, only about 500 children have been reunited with their parents in the weeks since the executive order, leaving over 1,500 families still separated. Disturbingly, there are signs that both the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Health and Human Services still don't have a viable plan in place to locate and bring children back to their mothers and fathers. While administration officials maintain that Mr. Trump's zero-tolerance edict was still in effect, spokespersons with Homeland Security acknowledged they are now releasing detained undocumented immigrants with a small fine or a promise to appear at a future court date, because the government doesn't have sufficient detention beds to house those arrested. Adding to the confusion, the president sent a tweet advocating that immigrants should be deported without judges or court cases to stop people being able to quote-unquote invade the U.S., essentially pushing for the unconstitutional denial of due process. All this has occurred as the Republican-controlled House and Senate appear incapable of passing immigration reform legislation into law. Your reporter spoke with Karina Moreno, assistant professor with Long Island University's School of Business, Public Administration, and Information Sciences. An immigrant from Monterrey, Mexico herself, here Professor Moreno discusses President Trump's reversal of his own policy of separating immigrant families and the conditions inside private for-profit immigrant detention centers run by companies supportive of Trump.
We had, of course, the Trump administration give a couple of warnings of what they were considering, you know, passing as law throughout their administration. And Jeff Sessions had said a couple times, be forewarned. This is not, you know, your things as usual. This is the Trump administration. And so we got the Zero Tolerance Initiative. And what that means is a couple of things. Number one, it meant family separation. This was completely new. So many issues having to do with the situation are not new, and we can link them to the Obama administration. We could link them to the previous administrations in power before. But family separation was absolutely one of the things novel and new about the Trump administration. Number two was women are not allowed to petition for asylum anymore on the grounds of domestic violence, which is a huge women's issue and huge human rights issue. Number three, families are no longer allowed to petition for asylum to the United States on the grounds of gang violence. And this is completely different from what we've seen in the past.
Karina, what are the prospects that we're going to see any substantive move to reunify these families with their children?
Well, the thing that we're seeing right now with the Trump administration is how the United States treats immigrants. And this includes asylum seekers, refugees, undocumented immigrants, humanitarian programs like TPS from Honduras, as well as legal immigrants that have green card status. Even though these children are taken in by the Department of Health and Human Services, we had over 1,500 children that were lost by the federal government. And this means that they were lost in the sense of the federal government handed over their custody to someone who claimed to be their sponsor or guardian, and then just didn't follow up with that person and doesn't know where they are. So they just lost track of them. It's a complete devaluing of brown lives, of immigrant lives, where they just say, you know what, it's not even worth the time. And so they've lost children.
Karina, I wanted to ask you about conditions in these immigration detention centers. From my understanding, many of these immigration detention centers are farmed out to private for-profit corporations. That's led to a lot of concern across the country about the conditions there and the accountability and transparency. Say a bit about what your major concerns are here with the private for-profit prison industry and their links with the Trump administration. Apparently, many of these corporate executives have given a lot of money to Mr. Trump during his campaign and continue to support him politically.
So there are two things that I want to say here. Number one, the private prison industry. We have two main companies. We have CoreCivic. Their name used to be Corrections Corporation of America, CCA. And we have the GEO Group. These two companies run about 75% of the detention industry. And the detention industry is a billion-dollar industry. CCA, just in 2008 and 2014, gave, in lobbying, over $10 million. The private prison industry directly lobbies the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Bureau of Prisons on these issues. This is very similar, Scott, to what happened during the war on drugs. During the war on drugs, the private prison industry sponsored different legislature that would ultimately benefit their bottom line. For example, three strikes laws, mandatory minimum sentencing, and so forth. The same tactics are now being used in what we call the war on terror. Now we have the private prison industry pushing for harsher legislation. The more harsh the legislation is, the more punitive it is, the more profitable it is. So it helps with mandatory detention. It helps with Arizona's Senate Bill 1070. It helps with the bed quota that the Department of Homeland Security has to have. These companies are financing political campaigns, people running for congressional office. And this is not one party. This is completely bipartisan. This is both Republicans and Democrats.
That was Karina Moreno, assistant professor with Long Island University's School of Business, Public Administration, and Information Sciences. Find more views on the Trump administration's immigration policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The people of Mexico, angry about a political elite they believe has done little or nothing to address the critical issues of a weak economy, rampant corruption, and drug violence, appear ready to shake up the status quo and elect progressive candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador president of the nation in a July 1st vote. Some 18,000 other federal, state, and municipal offices will also be filled that day, making this year's election the largest in Mexico's history. It's also been Mexico's most violent election cycle, with more than 120 candidates having been murdered since September 2017. López Obrador, affectionately known as AMLO, served as mayor of Mexico City from 2000 to 2005 and ran for president in 2006 and 2012. By many accounts, he actually won the 2006 election and mounted direct action protests while accusing the ruling class of stealing his victory. During this election campaign, López Obrador has vowed to crack down on government corruption and take a new approach to ending violence linked with powerful drug cartels. He also pledges to fight poverty and forcefully respond to U.S. President Donald Trump's constant insults directed toward the Mexican people. Your reporter spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas program with the Center for International Policy, who's based in Mexico City. Here she assesses López Obrador's candidacy and what changes his predicted victory will likely bring to Mexico and its impact on relations with the U.S.
Virtually every poll is giving him the election at this point. So when the ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, split and in 1988, very soon after, he was among those who broke off and created the left-wing party of the Democratic Revolution, which is known here by its initials PRD. And that party began to create a center-left alternative within Mexico City. But after a number of years, the PRD became very closely aligned with the powers that be, basically with the PRI and the PAN. They all got together at the beginning of the Peña Nieto presidency, who's the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, to form something called a Pact for Mexico that accepted a number of structural reforms that were pushed through Congress and that basically deepened the neoliberal economic model that's been imposed since the early 1980s. So he's been building an alternative. And then when the National Regeneration Movement split off from the PRD, he was the natural leader. He was the mayor of Mexico City and was generally considered to have initiated a number of positive changes. He's committed to some forms of redistribution of wealth, especially decreasing inequality by reducing corruption and the privileges that the super rich currently enjoy, as well as creating programs such as providing pensions to the elderly and more economic stimulation programs in the countryside where poverty has been so high that it's created, ever since the North American Free Trade Agreement in particular, this surge of migrants to the United States, and creating also different forms of support for other vulnerable sectors. So we have a candidate who could be considered close to social democrats. He doesn't identify as a socialist like Bernie Sanders, but he believes in a stronger role of the state in redistribution of wealth. And his main line that he repeats almost in response to any question is eliminating the corruption. And this really resonates.
Laura, I did want to ask you, what kind of role has Mexican nationalism played in this election campaign, given the many, many attacks that Donald Trump here in the United States has directed at Mexico and Mexicans? Tell us about what the atmosphere is around Trump, or does he have much to do with this election at all?
The biggest part of it is that with Donald Trump insulting Mexico all the time, there's one thing that Mexicans unite around, and that's repudiation of Donald Trump and his insults. López Obrador has been very careful about this. He's not coming out saying, I'm going to immediately, you know, obviously not cut off relationships with the United States. He said that we'll stay in NAFTA, but we're going to renegotiate on our terms. And he said that there has to be less economic dependency because this political dependency is largely seen as a result of the fact that Mexico has so much economic dependency on the United States, with some 80% of its trade with a single country, the United States. So he's saying that we're going to diversify trade, we're going to stimulate the internal market rather than being exclusively export-oriented according to this neoliberal model. So he's talking about making a number of changes, but he's not coming out with like the radical ideas that could really trigger a stronger reaction in Washington against his presidency. We're not talking about the firebrand and wild-eyed radical that sometimes the U.S. press likes to portray when it warns about a López Obrador's presidency. We're talking about someone who is a lifelong politician and fairly moderate within what could be called the center-left, you know, range of the spectrum.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program with the Center for International Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on Mexico's election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After six consecutive Mondays of moral witness in almost 40 states across the U.S., more than 1,000 local activists were arrested in civil disobedience actions as they rallied for an intersectional approach to the nation's many problems as part of the new Poor People's Campaign. This year's campaign comes 50 years after the action Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was organizing when he was assassinated in 1968. In addition to Dr. King's original triple threat protest targets of systemic racism, poverty, and militarism, this year's organizers added two additional threats, ecological devastation and our distorted national morality. The multi-state campaigns culminated in a rally on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., on Saturday, June 23rd. As several thousand people gathered on the mall, the event was live-streamed to many more across the country. Campaign organizers from each of the participating states, most of them poor themselves, addressed the crowd, which included people of all races, ages, and backgrounds. The campaign's two national co-chairs, United Church of Christ minister Liz Theo Harris and the Reverend Dr. William Barber, spoke last before an hour-long march to the Capitol. In his short speech, Reverend Barber, who initiated Moral Monday protests while head of the North Carolina NAACP, emphasized that the gathering on the Mall marked the beginning, not the end, of the new Poor People's Campaign. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and recorded this excerpt of Reverend Barber's speech.
Today, you are the founding members of the 21st Century Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. We gather today for a call to action. We gather here declaring it's time for a moral uprising all across America. This is not a commencement, this is a commencing. This is not the commemoration of what happened 50 years ago. This is the reenactment and the re-inauguration. Because you do not commemorate prophets and prophetic movements. You go where the blood, where they fell, and reach down in the blood and pick up the baton and carry it the next mile of the way. For 3 years, we've been laying a foundation from the bottom up, not the top down, because helicopter leadership will not save us. Today, from this stage, no person will speak at the podium by themselves. Today, because of the continuing reality of two Americas, one land, the land of the very few with extreme lot, and the other land of the many with the very little who suffer DOTS, daily ongoing stress syndrome of their lives, and the attention violence by the political culture toward the poor. We are here. People are watching by live stream around the country and the world. We are here to call the nation to action, to get our marching order. We are here to put a face on the facts of poverty. We are here of every race, every color, every creed, every income, every faith tradition, especially the poor, coming together, declaring that we must have a poor people's not march, a poor people's not rally, but a poor people's campaign to save not the Republican Party, to save not the Democratic Party, but to save the very heart and the soul of this nation. Don't get it twisted. We are not the left. We are not the right. We are not the conservative. We are not the liberal, because those phrases are too puny and too weak and too limited. No, this campaign is standing in the deep moral tradition, in the deep religious and moral traditions that have always been necessary throughout history in order to lift those at the bottom and save countries from destroying their own potential. We are in the same moral tradition of the prophets of Israel who challenged kings and rulers to stop legislating evil. We are in the same moral tradition of Jesus, whose evangelical work was not being against gay people, but being against poverty. We are in the same moral tradition of the Apache and other indigenous spiritual people who taught us to care and not destroy and poison the air, water, and the land. We are in the same moral tradition of the abolitionists who knew if slavery was legal, it was still immoral and it had to be challenged. We are in the same moral tradition of the Reconstructionists who, after the Civil War, fought for equal protection under the law. We are in the same moral tradition as the social gospel movement who looked at poverty and corporate greed and asked, what would Jesus do? We are in the same moral tradition of those who fought for labor unions and decent wages and 8-hour work days, even when they were killed and hung in places like Chicago. We are in the same moral tradition as Cesar Chavez and MLK and Rabbi Heschel and Fannie Lou Hamer and Swana Cheney and Goodman and Rosa Parks and Unitarian and Muslims like Malcolm and gay people and social justice activists like Bayard Rushton. We stand in the same moral tradition that have always fought to help this nation be a little more grounded in love, truth, and peace, and to come a little closer to being a more perfect union. This is who we are. Make no mistake, America, you've got to get a new lexicon for this. You won't be able to report this like you've normally reported it. We are black, we are white, we are brown, we are red, we are yellow, we are gay, we are straight, we are old, we are urban, we are rural, we are Jewish, we are Christian, we are Hindus, we are Muslim, we are people of faith, we are people not of faith, from Alaska to Alabama to the deep south in Mississippi to northern Maine, from California to the Carolinas, from the Midwest, from the Rust Belt to the Wheat Belt. We are the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. And we won't be silent anymore.
That was Reverend Dr. William Barber, co-chair of the 2018 Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.